Talk show about hot takes out of the hot takes. Pancakes for the windows, to the walls, to the boys talk about jaws. Oh, damn sharks, they crawl. Oh, shark fin. I don't know. I didn't think of that through too well.
That might be an all-timer.
Yeah, you like
that? Was a great one.
Oh, fantastic. I literally put on the theme music and said, I forgot to think of a rhymey thingy. Anyway, if this is your first time, Popaholics, I'm your wacky ass host, Christian Cady, and I'm joined as always by my two fellow scuba divers,
Chris Conkling
and Brian Dupree. And Christian, I think we have another guest here tonight with us as well.
We do.
Just to be clear,
we do. I do have good old Riot Pooper. That's his official name, in my lap because he was being loud during the weekly upload. So I'm sitting here petting him and perusing him. So I've got my own little predator of my own sitting in my lap. So, Riot, do you want to say anything? Like, you can kind of hear him licking his lips. I'm glad. Nope. I'm glad he's quiet.
He's silent.
I'm glad. Good. Good. Mission accomplished. So what are we talking about on today's episode? Well, we are springing into summer with a little bit of Spielberg. I believe we chose that. I was like, as we were prepping for everything, I was like, is it because of West Side Story? That's why we're doing it? Not actually covering Steven Spielberg's West Side Story?
No, we just wanted to cover Spielberg.
Honestly, to get to the source of it, I think I sent you guys something when we watched Eraserhead. I sent you guys an image that I compared between Eraserhead and Close Encounters, and you told me you'd never seen Close Encounters, and I was like, okay, it's time for Spielberg month. And
there it is.
We agreed.
It's kind of like harkening back to our artist spotlights. We had a couple of those. We did one for Nolan. We did one for Chris Nolan. We did a quick Kanye one going over his discography, right? We haven't done
Spike
one in a while.
Lee.
So Spike Lee. So
we
this
Spike Lee.
Oh, that is true. So this is kind of like our yearly little spotlight we do. And what better director than the father? I believe I'm going to say right here on this show, super original thought, father of like modern cinema, Steven Spielberg, certainly one of the most influential directors of our generation. And so who doesn't love to gush over some good old classic Spielberg? So we begin with not his first, but definitely his first huge success, where Spielberg started to become a household name, and that is with 1975's Jaws.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws. This is Universal's extraordinary motion picture version.
That was a turn.
Peter Benchley's best-selling novel.
Yeah, really flipped the script on tone here.
Real.
Yeah, it's like right as they like drop the title too. That is from the trailer of Jaws, the original trailer. For 1975's Jaws, let's go through the fun facts of Jaws here. Directed by Mr. Steven Spielberg, written by Peter Benchley and Carl Gottlieb. With a score by John Williams. No surprises there. The beginning of a blossoming relationship. Did he do Sugarland Express was the first feature. Did John Williams do? Nope. Everybody's giving me a question mark. I don't believe he did, but we'll have the fact guys check that out. With a budget of $9 million, it grossed $472 million. So a little bit of a success. Stars Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, Lorraine Gray, Murray Hamilton, Carr Gottlieb, Jeffrey Kramer, Susan Backline, Lee Fierro, and Peter Benchley. And what are we going to be
just
talking about?
Dropping it in, John Williams did do Sugarland Express as well.
Wow. So it's
they've been buds, first movie.
Been buds forever. What I guess it would be like what Spielberg movies haven't had John Williams. I know they've existed. I know they're out there, but man, it's crazy to think that they've had that long of a relationship together. Very cool. So what are we going to be talking about with Jaws? We are going to be talking about our history with the man, Steven Spielberg, and Jaws, our history, personally, so you know where we're coming from when we're talking about this, and our overall non-spoiler thoughts. We'll then dive into themes and some of our favorite moments and wrap up with final thoughts. So it should be pretty concise, quick boy. But we'll see. I don't know. You can start talking about Spielberg. Who knows how long you can ramble on for.
Oh, it could go on and on.
It could go on. Chris watched 18 documentaries, so we shall see. But let's dive in with our history with Steven Spielberg. Brian, why don't you start us off?
Sure. So I kind of grew up with Steven Spielberg in some capacity. E.T. was something that I saw very young and was very drawn to early, as well as Jurassic Park, one of the bigger, scarier movies that I saw relatively young in my life. After that, Indiana Jones was in that time frame too. I saw the Indiana Jones movies, honestly, my dad showed them to me too young, because Temple of Doom, I definitely had nightmares from the heart scene that is absolutely
Kalima.
Terrifying. But yeah, so relatively exposed to Spielberg from a very early age. I think I watched Schindler's List in middle school. I think it was shown to me in middle school in one of my classes, if I remember correctly, which I need to come back to it. But wild that I saw that in public school. Shout out Florida Public Education. But yeah, from there, I saw War of the Worlds when it came out. Minority Report, I saw a little later in high school as well. And then I went back to some of the classics in college time frame with Jaws and Close Encounters and AI. And I actually haven't seen pretty much anything that he's made in the last like decade and a half. And it feels like a gap, especially coming back to this. And it's just like, how am I sleeping on this man? The type of movies he's making and what they've been about as of late haven't been as up my alley. But I have to go and get through eventually this whole man's catalog, because he's one of the most prolific, on top of being making just great movies consistently as well. But yeah, so Jaws, I didn't have a crazy childhood traumatic experience with it, but I came to it later after already appreciating him. And yeah, I'm definitely excited to dig into it with you guys.
Steven Spielberg for me is the first director as a child that I was ever able to identify. And this was from a very early age, you know, as a budding cinephile. I think we all remember like the first director where we could we would see his name in a credit, or we would see a piece of work, or in Steven Spielberg's case, we would see the Amblin production logo and go, Steven Spielberg's involved with this.
Yeah.
So just like Brian, films like E.T. and Indiana Jones and Jurassic Park were all staples of my childhood. But not only that, I used to watch Tiny Toons and Animaniacs and Freakazoid, which were all Steven Spielberg Presents television shows. You also had all the Don Bluth animated films, which were made by Amblin Entertainment. So when I think Steven Spielberg, I think of like childhood and just Americana cinema. Like if you ask me, who do I think represents America cinema best, I would automatically say Steven Spielberg, because there's just something about him that exudes that feeling, you know, of like summertime, being a kid. It's something that like I think the Duffer Brothers were able to tap into with Stranger Things. That show's very like Spielbergian. Do you guys know like what I'm
getting
at? Yeah,
there's something like nostalgic and awe-inspiring.
It's like apple pie, man.
Yeah,
it's just, you know, always with the combination of John Williams scores. Yeah, a lot of his early work, especially, and some of his later work, taps into this idea of wonder and really making even the ordinary magnificent. Right?
There's whimsy involved.
There's so much. I don't know. It's that childhood feeling of discovery that he's able to encapsulate so well.
There's a sense of like adventure in a lot of his earlier works. But Brian, like you, I actually saw a lot of his films in theaters probably up to 2010. But over the last decade, I really haven't, outside of Ready Player One, which I think is probably the only Steven Spielberg movie that I've seen in theaters since 2010, I haven't seen The Post. I haven't gone back and seen Lincoln. I haven't seen War Horse.
Bridge of Spies.
So like a lot of his... Bridge of Spies, yes. So a lot of these newer Spielberg movies, I'm ashamed to say, I've yet to see, but I would love to see. We're not going to be tackling any of those films in part one of our springing into summer with Spielberg month, but I'm really hoping to do a part two and maybe even a part three at some point, because I think this man is hugely deserving of our attention. In terms of Jaws, I didn't see Jaws when I was a kid. I saw it for the first time in high school, and then I didn't revisit it. But Jaws prevailed in the pop culture zeitgeist growing up for me. It was just part of pop culture. I remember being a little kid in my swimming pool and like making a shark fin with my hand and not having even seen Jaws, but knowing what the theme song was, you know? Yeah. So it's just something that has really penetrated pop culture, even to kids who've maybe never been exposed to the movie itself.
See, I do want to say too, I didn't see the movie until much later, but I had been to Universal Studios and been on the ride, which kind of walks you through the basic plot of the movie. So I did have some in there conceptually to what it was, but obviously it was very ubiquitously in the culture too.
Ryan, to that point, one of the most surreal experiences of my life is riding the Jaws ride in Osaka, Japan, at Universal Studios Japan, and the entire script being in Japanese, but being so familiar with like how that ride pans out. And we got off the ride and I was like, the only word that I was able to recognize in Japanese was shark, which is same.
Yeah,
I was like, I don't need to understand the rest.
Because all everybody like at one point
shark?
Yells, same. Yeah.
It was part of the script. But it was super weird because I was so familiar with that ride growing up in the Florida area and going to Universal Studios Orlando. Like, I was so familiar with the ride. Going through it in Japanese was like a very strange experience.
That's super cool. I'm going to jump on this like Steven Spielberg memory road train that we got going on. You know, we're all 90s kids. So I just think Spielberg is very like essential to not only my childhood, but like my adult life as well. I really can't, I can't really put into words how much Spielberg has influenced all parts of my life. Jurassic Park, obviously E.T., very like early stuff. I loved the Jurassic Park. That was really, that whole series, even the lesser films in it, really was my jam. I've seen that movie so many times, and to think one director just has like so much brain space in my development is crazy. But even then, I watched a ton of Indiana Jones, the original one. I actually did not cycle through Temple of Doom too much, but Last Crusade and the original one were on repeat constantly. I owned VHS copies of that, but also I've seen E.T. Quite a few times. And then going into like teenage years, Saving Private Ryan, one of the first like rated R movies that I saw, I definitely watched that a few times, as well as Hook. Going back into childhood, I forgot I loved Hook.
Wow.
And Hook. I love this, like, there's a resurgence is from the YouTube critics that I follow of like love for Hook, of like, hey, Hook, we loved it, right? Like, and yes, we did. I loved Hook. Revisiting some of his lesser hits like AI, I've revisited in the last like few years. Really dig that movie. That's a very interesting movie.
I saw that in theaters.
Literally like an homage to one of his favorite directors and one of yours, Brian, Kubrick. It's like Spielberg embodying like Kubrick's influence into a film. Very interesting. And Minority Report, so there's a run of films. Minority Report, Catch Me If You Can, and The Terminal. Mm-hmm. That I loved as a younger teenager.
Three greats.
This man is ridiculous, dude.
Catch Me If You Can is one of my favorite movies. I love it, and it's interesting because I have a very quick aside. My dad used to work for selling like checking fraud insurance. So my dad has met Frank Abagnale, the real person. And so my dad loved this movie.
Awesome.
And I've watched this with my dad more than once, which is like rare that I've had a movie that I've watched. But like, if I went home and was like, can we watch Catch Me If You Can? We both watch it and both love it. I've seen it with my girlfriend. I've seen it by myself. I've seen it with my dad. Like, it's like, I concur. It's so good. And Minority Report, I think if you've slept on that, if you haven't caught that in a while, like that's a fun sci-fi thriller. Like, very, very, very great. The Terminal, like, I haven't revisited in a while, but I remember liking it when I saw it. I saw it like a couple times.
It's a really sweet film.
War of the Worlds, I saw in theaters was probably the first Spielberg movie actually that I saw in theaters, which it came out in like 2004 or five or something. So I was like prime age of going to the movie theaters and like didn't love it, but there's a lot of good stuff in that film. Munich, I watched when I had a severe flu right before I went to Europe. And that's like a good engaging, like historical thriller. Crystal Skull, I saw in theaters. That's probably one of the biggest stinkers. I still haven't seen War Horse. Recently revisited Lincoln, and I gotta say, holy shit, everybody was wrong about Lincoln. That movie is a masterpiece. I love that movie. I think it speaks to a lot of stuff happening now. If you haven't seen Lincoln in a while, okay. I think, and it mostly,
it's Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln, right?
It's really, Spielberg was like, Daniel Day-Lewis is great. I'm gonna film him portraying a very important historical character and letting that just breathe really well with a very like tight script. And then more recently, I saw Ready Player One in theaters, which I think is a little bit of a miss, but you know, it's fine for what it is. And there's still like an epic scene in that movie. There's still a scene in that movie worth talking about. Again, in homage to Kubrick. So yeah,
it still feels like Steven Spielberg, that movie. Yeah. But it's just not on par with some of his other works, I think.
And that's something you get when you go into a Spielberg movie. It's like, it's Spielberg. You're like, am I going to be like wowed and have childhood? And there's like, he's always tapping into that at certain points in his stuff. And is always, there's great stuff in all of his work. It's just some of it doesn't live up, and it's hard when you just make bangers all the time to like really live up to your previous awesome. Like every time I see a Spielberg movie, I'm having to compare him to like Jurassic Park. That's not fair. No one deserves to be compared to Jurassic Park, right? Like, I'm working on a couple music videos, all right? Midnight Satire, shameless plug for my stuff. And it's, I'm getting back into directing. It's very, like, fulfilling. But I'm reminded of how hard it is to make, like, really good visual content. And that's where my respect... You'll notice the more I'm doing work in visual content, the more I'm, like, cool with bad shit. Because I'm like, this is just really hard, so I respect. But if I like showed my music video I worked really hard on, spent a lot of time on, someone was like, well, there's no Jurassic Park. I'd be like, of course it's fucking not Jurassic Park. What? That's not even fair. And Spielberg has to be compared to Jurassic Park every time he makes something. That's just not cool.
Not even the Jurassic Park sequels are Jurassic Park.
Yeah, or Schindler's List. Like,
yeah.
It's not fair. The man has done crazy work, so... and you know, going back, we're talking about Jaws, just to redirect it. I've never seen Jaws A to B. This is my first time watching Jaws A to B. I've seen a lot of Jaws over the course of my life. I've seen quite a bunch of it. I've seen most of Jaws. I believe I've seen all of Jaws as a whole, but never actually sat down and watched Jaws front to back.
I've seen bloody chunks of Jaws, but I've seen never
many bloody chunks. I've seen like the last like 30 minutes, maybe 100 times, but I, for whatever reason, syndication, all that, I just never have like revisited and been like, I'm going to watch all of Jaws right now until this podcast. And, you know, we're going to talk about it with our overall opinions. You know, obviously a lot of like personal connection to the director, and seriously, like a laundry list of like some of my favorite stuff that's come out and some stuff that I think is underrated. And I still haven't seen War Horse, and like, we're big fans of, we'll shout it out here, the Slash Film cast inspired this show, you know, in a lot of ways. And, David Chen loves War Horse, and I have not seen it to this day. And, revisiting Lincoln and watching Jaws all the way through for the first time has made me go like, I should probably go watch War Horse. And then a lot of this other stuff on the list.
That's why I'm telling you guys, multi-part Steven Spielberg spotlight.
Hey, we'll probably have to revisit it. It's too big for one. Spielberg, too big for 1 month. I'll say it right now.
For the next three summers.
Yeah. Maybe we'll have to. So let's get into the actual film that we're talking about, which is Jaws. What are our overall thoughts revisiting Jaws all these years later? Does it hold up? Chris, start with you.
So I don't say this about many films. I hold this description for a select few films, some of which are also Spielberg films. But to me, Jaws is a perfect movie. Other movies that I would deem perfect movies: Jurassic Park, like Christian said, Back to the Future. E.T. is a fantastic movie. I don't know if it's a perfect movie, but I think Jaws is a perfect movie. And the reason I think Jaws is a perfect movie is because of what Steven Spielberg is able to accomplish, having faced so many challenges during the production. He he met those challenges and he transformed them into cinematic magic. Like, this film gives you a genuinely, it genuinely terrifies you, right? For those that don't know, he had huge problems when it came to getting the shark to function properly in the water. And what that translated into was him not being able to film the shark. But what that gave us was these scenes throughout the movie where he's like right on the horizon of the water. Like, it's about the implication of the shark being there.
It's the implication. And you're not in any danger.
It's about the implication. It's about the implication. But there's already this innate discomfort when it comes to humans and the ocean, because it's so deep and because it's so vast and because there's so many unknown elements within it. I think our lizard brains are naturally afraid of it, right? And somehow Steven Spielberg was able to harness that fear and, like I said, take that challenge and turn it into, like I said, cinema magic, right? And on top of being able to have us feel such intense fear while watching the movie, this is also a really excellent adventure film. So I don't know. I really don't have anything bad to say about Jaws. And I know that's has been probably said a million times before. This movie has a huge following. It's considered the original blockbuster. So it's wholly responsible for like what Hollywood looks like right now during the summer season. But yeah, this movie to me is a perfect movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's Jaws. It's absolutely unbelievable. Every time I come back to it, any Spielberg, he reminds me of why he's one of the greats. What surprised me this time, the movie is almost like a slasher. It starts off like with slasher horror tropes.
It is.
And I forgot how much it feels like a straight up horror movie to a large degree. The fact that the ratings always weird me out. Pre-PG-13, seeing this movie rated PG and just being so bold in its kills, and it uses the graphic stuff, like you said. The implication is where this movie shines, and the slight bits that they do give you are perfect and just truly terrifying stuff.
Without being overly grotesque, right?
No, exactly. Exactly.
Right on that clean line. Yeah.
And it felt revolutionary to see the shots from beneath in the water. There's something so, like you said, deeply and ancient dread that comes from this fear of the unknown in the ocean. And yeah, there's something primal about it. On top of that, this movie has some of the best monologues in cinema for me, hands down.
Absolutely.
And the performances that are delivered are all super solid. It's tightly written. You generally like all the characters. The characters are all very well defined. I think to say one tiny negative about the movie, I think the movie shines when the shark is largely not on screen. So towards the back half, I think maybe we could do for even slightly less of the shark than we end up getting. Maybe shortening up a little bit on the adventure side of things, because I think the movie really shines in the first two thirds. But front to back, I'm just nitpicking because I was never bored throughout this movie. I think that is where it shows its age most, but even when the shark doesn't look necessarily totally real, the tension is still real. It's still tense, even though it's like, okay, I'm kind of taken out of it a little bit. But yeah, it does some classic jump scares, but it also does some non-musical cue scares that are just like, oh my God, this is insane and genuinely great scares. So yeah, I mean, what can we say about it? It's Spielberg's directing as well. Christian, please, just let's continue heaping the praise. What did you think this time around?
Before, do you mind if I piggyback off of that really quick, Brian?
No, please.
You mentioned that the film feels like a slasher film almost at the very beginning of it.
Yeah.
And as I was rewatching Jaws this time around, I was thinking to myself how Spielberg, and I would define it, I know I used the term whimsy earlier, but like, I would almost define his style, at least in those earlier days, as like whimsical horror movies, you know, because yes, this movie has horror elements, but it's kind of more an adventure movie than a horror movie. you know, or yeah. like a merging yeah. of the two. Even E.T. has horror elements to it, but that's a, I mean, you would define that movie as a children's movie, and yet there's genuinely scary moments in there as well. So I think Spielberg early on was able to like ride this line of like making family movies that also had an element of fear in them. And there was a whole era that was able to do this, you know, like with the Goonies and all these other films. Like it feels like a type of genre that was very prevalent in the 1970s and 1980s.
But I think childlike,
which is like where he shined a lot.
I think childlike wonder also like encapsulates what you're talking about, Chris, which is when you're a Definitely. Kid, all these feelings are exaggerated. And in film, he's able to capture emotions of our characters and people in the most like childlike fear and wonder kind of way. Like there's just this like viewpoint that is always pull. It's like, and this has to do with a lot with the work in the cinematography. It's like our attention is always pulled and the scene is always influenced by the visuals and the music in such a powerful way that just naturally emotionally grabs you in a way that just so few directors and filmmakers can really grab and is really that special sauce. And I think that leads to that, whether it's a scene in someone being scared of a dinosaur or an alien or anything, of like, where would you be if you were eight and experiencing this moment, right? And
right.
Capturing it on all levels. You know, my shark movie, when I think of childhood, is actually not Jaws. Can you guys guess what shark movie is like closest
Deep
to my
heart? Deep Blue Sea?
Yeah, 100%.
That's what I would guess too.
Deep Blue Sea is my Jaws. It is. And you know, it's cool. And I think you can appreciate, and you may be listening and going like, Deep Blue Sea sucks. Don't you dare compare it to Jaws. They are on different
that
levels.
Suck.
They are on different levels, for sure. However, Deep Blue Sea wouldn't exist without Jaws. And Deep Blue Sea knows all the important things that Jaws, all the stuff that made Jaws really great. And watching Jaws reminded me of how much I love Deep Blue Sea. And it's very silly. It's like my love of like Eight-Legged Freaks meets Jaws, right?
Incredible climactic monologue in that as well that ends in a different way
yeah.
Yeah.
Ours.
Yeah.
For sure. And, you know, the suspense and scaling and size and all that stuff is working really well. But, you know, I don't have as big of an emotional attachment to Jaws as I do to Spielberg or Deep Blue Sea. But it's really awesome watching this and just being like, like instantly I text you guys. I was maybe 15 minutes in the movie and I was like, shit. Because we got, you know, Chris was like, I bought the 4K Ultra Blu-ray. And I was like, yeah, I should probably get that too. You know, just with all the special features. And it has the Blu-ray and also the digital, and it wasn't much more than the digital, so let's do it.
It was actually a great deal on Amazon.
It was a great, I really recommend this transfer. It's awesome. Really, if you have a good, I wish I had a better TV, but just like the contrast in the shots, especially the opening shots of the sunset and the backlit silhouettes, like it's just gorgeous. Like absolutely like mastercraft of framing and composition. Yeah, I could go on a whole rant. We could make this entire podcast about Steven Spielberg's ability with his DP to just pull focus, really. There's one shot that really was like, I was like, fuck, this time. And it's going through the crowd of beachgoers, and then it lands on our protagonist and pulls focus right.
Brody.
And oh my
God. It's such a good shot.
It is like, so good. And there's so much of that. You get that classic. This was something they, you know, we're based in Central Florida. There's a school out here, Full Sail, and when me and Chris were studying film, I was going up to learn about the colleges, and one of the shots they use to talk about techniques they'll teach you is the shot when Brody realizes that there's another shark attack happening right in front of his eyes, and it's the one where the camera is on a dolly going in to Brody, and the focus is being pulled out, and you're like, that's literally
vertigo shot.
Taught in film class, and it just, you know, and it's actually used a couple of times in different ways throughout this picture and throughout Spielberg's career, but just like the dude made up a shot. Come on, that's like Citizen Kane level shit of like, I made up a way to shoot shit. And influenced obviously by Hitchcock and his predecessors, but that's the definitive way that you describe it. I want that shot in Jaws, right? I want that pull of tension. So just so much from the, I was really paying attention to the framing, but I think what, after that glossiness, you know, wears off a little bit, and you're just kind of, you know, the movie isn't just that. The performance by Richard Dreyfuss and Robert Shaw.
Oh, so good.
It's, you know, I recently watched Dreyfuss in What About Bob? He's excellent in that. But even this, so, is more, it's such a, it feels so modern. And I feel like I overused that term, but there's this term of like timelessness to his performance as the, you know, the rich oceanographer who's really passionate about something. Like, he feels like he could be played by Zach Galifianakis today. Like, and Zach Galifianakis would be having to give a great performance to even match up to what Dreyfuss is performing, but it has that character actor vibe to it. And then Robert Shaw is going way too hard as Quint, who is the sailor person. The way he's introduced is almost comical.
He's the Ahab. He's an Ahab, absolutely.
I mean, just absolutely. You want to? I had to put on subtitles to like understand everything he was saying because he's landed on pretty thick. But the perform, like, I think the cinematography makes this thing move and makes it feel so watchable today. And then the performances are what like make it a long-standing thing. I don't think it's a perfect film. I think it is a perfect blockbuster. I think it's a perfect blockbuster. It is not a perfect film. And that's not to diminish it in any way, but I would separate some of Spielberg's other work and other artists' work as perfect films. Well, you know, we recently said this, the last time we dropped this was on The Truman Show. And I think that's because The Truman Show is acting and very influenced by Spielberg stuff, but it is frame composed and moves like a Spielberg movie, but it's about so much more. And as we'll talk about as we move into spoilers and themes, I'm not sure Jaws is about much more than the sum of its parts. In the most polite way, I can say that it is perfectly crafted as an adventure, an experience of watching a film, which is what the blockbuster promises. The blockbuster promises, I'm going to go in with a bunch of people, we're going to go on a fun ride, and we're going to get off and go, wow, wasn't that fun? But beyond that, other than being terrified of water and sharks and the unknown or whatever, I'm not sure it adds anything. It adds much more. There is stuff to talk about, and I'll actually have a really, I think I have a really fun 2021 parallel that I could speak to that I saw in the themes. But that is solely because of large archetypes and what we've gone through in the past couple of years that I can speak to that. And I think those things are true. But as far as a film tour de force of all the Spielbergian wonder and all that, adding with a really important contextual thing that matters front to back, which I think is an important distinction, because I feel like this is two separate movies that we could talk about. This movie really enters another realm that feels like it has very little to do with the first realm, but they're very entertaining and they're very...
It becomes very isolated.
Yeah, and yeah. They're both very good movies, but it's like two kind of separate sorts of movies together, mm-hmm. which is cool, but I don't think they have a ton to do with each other. And that means it's not perfect. It means that... Boy, they saved it on set and they saved it in the edit. Because I saw some of them deleted scenes, and I gotta say, it wasn't all gold, and the things on the cutting room floor were best left there, and it was saved, certainly.
But that's why those scenes end up on the cutting room floor. And you know, Christian, I want to push back a little bit to you saying that this is a perfect blockbuster. Because prior to this film existing, that was not a thing. Blockbusters did not exist before Jaws came out. Mm-hmm. In fact, and you're aware of this, you watch the documentaries, the way in which this film was released was nationwide all at the same time, where prior to this film existing, they would roll out movies in different states and cities gradually. So the whole country wouldn't be able to see something all at once. Jaws was the first to do that. So I don't think it's fair to say that this is a perfect blockbuster. I genuinely believe that this is a perfect film. It did set the bar for blockbusters, but so few blockbusters are able to deliver on the quality that Jaws is able to deliver. I genuinely disagree with you in saying that it's a perfect blockbuster. This is a perfect movie, and it defined a genre, but there are so, like I said, there's so few films in that blockbuster that reach this bar. I just can't agree that it's limited to the blockbuster genre.
I'm not going to get into
again,
semantics.
Film is subjective.
You.
Film is subjective.
I don't want to argue semantics about best blockbuster versus best film. I would say the reason for my distinction.
I think it's deserving of saying that it's a perfect movie and not being limited. That's my main point.
I would say that a lot of films have copied this. It's certainly important. It's certainly an important film. I think there's a lot of negative things that come from the type of movie this is. I mean, there's like six sequels that aren't worth shit. There's a whole bunch of movies that...
But the reason... No, continue. I'm sorry.
Right, and I don't put that on Spielberg. I don't put that on this film. But what I'd put on is like, there's tropes of this type of movie and the nationwide release that aren't done to this level, right? And right. It defined a type of movie that would come out. So certainly it's important.
And so what I would say to that is, and this is something I was actually thinking about while watching the movie, is that you're right. We've gotten so many copycats and so many parodies of Jaws since the 1970s. And yet all of those films, including Deep Blue Sea, have never been able to handle the material as seriously as Jaws did. Jaws 100% takes everything that it's doing seriously, whereas every other aquatic monster movie that has come out since Jaws has been, you know, there's been a little winking involved. They've been parodies of what Jaws was. So you're right. No other copycat has been able to live up to this movie. But again, this is why I think Jaws is a perfect film, is because they were taking the material seriously and they weren't poking fun at it, where everything following did.
And
even if they thought they were being serious, there was always like a little like a wink and a nod, you know, nudge nudge, as Monty Python would say.
Well, I wouldn't define perfection as breaking the fourth wall or not breaking the fourth wall. I don't think that has anything to do with the literary or, you know, content of it. You know, you can say it's a more genuine film. It's more authentic to the story that's being told. I can understand that. I don't think that level of it really affects its level of perfection. I would say it's not a perfect film in the fact that it is not it's not super cohesive at the end of the day as a work of fiction. It's not like you end it and go, ah, a greater truth about humanity, because you really don't. The movie isn't about much more with its two disparate parts more than, you know, man versus nature on a very fundamental adventure enjoyment level. I think there is
a through line that we can talk about when we transition to themes.
Yeah, maybe you'll help me discover a more consistent through line throughout the whole picture. But aside from being generally about man versus nature, I personally don't see that at this junction. And especially the type of movie that it is, it feels a little disjointed in that way. Not to take away from how enjoyable the movie is, I just think that when I think of Jaws and what it does really well, it does a lot. It does everything at the surface level of the water, the shoreline, if you will, to perfection. But there are some nuts and bolts that I think Spielberg surpasses himself later in his career. And certainly other movies have surpassed. Maybe not in the specific aquatic threat category. I won't try to think of other aquatic threats. I think Deep Blue Sea is just as fun and entertaining. I think this movie is more consistent tone-wise and skillfully made, and I would not try to say that Deep Blue Sea is better, but I would say Deep Blue Sea is just as entertaining for me as a viewer as this movie, and offers almost as much depth as far as what it's trying to say about humanity, right? Brian, we've gone over. Do you have any input on this blockbuster versus film perfection debate?
Well, it's interesting because we talked about Shane Black on Monday's episode in our throwback, and I feel like Shane Black is very much like writes this sort of movie. Maybe not blockbuster exactly, but it's that same ballpark where I think what's great about it is that it can be so ridiculously easily accessible, grounded in some mm-hmm. level of reality, and still actually do a couple things that I don't want to... there's stuff that's revealed in this movie and ways that characters act, ways that a town deals with crisis that I think are very true and speak to bigger truths still today. I do agree that the end doesn't necessarily have those things pay off. But one of the speeches that we get, I don't know if it's a spoiler, the famous monologue in this movie was information that had only very recently been declassified. And so that was probably the first time the vast majority of people's first experience hearing about this event from World War II. So that in itself was kind of a radical thing, in my opinion, when I learned that in the documentary that we watched.
Not only was it the first experience for some viewers, just learning about it. But for some of the parents who had lost children during that event, during World War II, it was the first time they learned of how their children perished. They had no idea because it was classified for such a long time. And we're beating around the bush here, kind of. But I mean, it's a
we're surfing around the turf. I don't know. Well, those are our general thoughts. Let us not delay no further. Let's jump into spoilers for Jaws in case you haven't seen it. like I hadn't seen it all the way through. So, you know, this was especially for people like me. So let's jump into spoilers. Fun fact about our spoiler theme. Don't know if you heard the correlation between our spoiler theme and Jaws, but that is incorporating Dies Irae, which is John Williams loves Dies Irae.
Music theorist over here. My goodness.
It's kind of like a monk, old choral chant.
Chant.
Yeah, chant that incorporates that sequence of notes. And John Williams uses part of that for the beginning of Dun Dun. That is the first part. And that is something they'd use to imply doom and fear and is consistent in a lot of modern as well as a lot of John Williams scores and also from like the mid 20th century scores. So fun little music fact. I figured it was particularly appropriate for the spoiler bumper.
Definitely.
John Williams. Well, let's jump into themes here. And Chris, I do want to start with you because you seemed like you had so much to say about the themes of this movie. I'm particularly interested in the themes that carry over throughout. I have some themes for the beginning and the later part of the movie that don't really correspond with each other, but I'd like to hear you try to wrap this up in a bow.
I agree with you. I think there are kind of three separate themes taking place here. You know, at the start of the film and in the, if we're going to divide the film up, which I mean, it makes sense. There is kind of a clear division,
on the boat, first portion on of the land,
movie, on the land during the, on the land portion of the film, I think there's a clear, anti-capitalism message being placed here, especially considering that the mayor is like the main antagonist of this section of the movie. And we have Brody really trying to push back against him, not wanting to close the beaches because the town's going to lose a ton of money and they won't be able to make it through the year. So the mayor is willing to put his capitalist nature and his desire to make money ahead of human lives countless times.
That's
and all the killings that take place.
I don't understand this theme. I can't think of anything recently.
Completely unrealistic.
It's unrealistic. I don't know what situation you could compare this to in the real life that would make any sense. Public health crisis. Lives are at risk.
Who could possibly tie this to real
life? There's
a
4th of July party to have. I don't get it. I'm at a loss for words.
It's not topical at all. It makes no sense. So that's not the carry through theme that I was talking about. And you're right. There is a clear surface level, like man versus nature element, because it's Brody facing off against a giant shark. But I think the through line of this movie is about conquering your fear. We never learn why Brody is afraid of water. We're solely told that he is, which is one of the more disappointing aspects of the film, I think. I would have preferred to know what type of trauma like started this fear, but we are told that our protagonist is deathly afraid of water. He never gets in the water outside of it, the third act of the film where he has to get onto the orca to fight Jaws. And in the end of the film, he's the one to kill Jaws, to kill the shark. The Jaws isn't the name of the shark, but he's the one to kill the shark. So I do think there is...
It's Mr. Jaws.
Mr. Jaws is the name of this shark. I do think there is an overarching theme of conquering your fears in this film, especially considering that one of the last lines of the film is Brody saying, you know, I used to be so afraid of water. And then Hooper going, I can't imagine why. Yeah. So I do think that there is a complete message to the whole film.
I'm going to tie this in.
That's just my takeaway.
Tying this in. Brody is actually a fake name. This is Truman post getting out. And he turns into Brody. This extended universe to...
Welcome to Brian's Wacky Conspiracy Corner.
Truman Show prequel to Jaws. But yeah, continue, Chris.
I love it. I love it.
Chris, in all your research, I do have a question. You watched a lot of behind the scenes. When I was watching the little bit of the behind the scenes that we get on the Ultra Blu-ray transfer, which is really wonderful. You should pick it up. You know, they have a lot of talkie head time with the writer of the book. Now, do you know the themes that were explored in the book that might have differed? Because there's several stories that were cut out because they were like, the studio was like A to B adventure.
Yeah, there was like a romantic element that was cut out of the book. The journalist was heavily cut out for the movie. I don't recall him expressing
thematically
any explicit themes.
Yeah, I'd be interested
in like definitively going, these are the themes of my book.
Sure.
You know?
As well, all great artists don't really typically do that.
Right. Exactly.
I am curious to know if there was other themes in the book that were more heavily prescient.
It's possible.
Than in the
I've never read the book, so I can't say.
Yeah, none of us have because we are the Popaholics. Brian, your thoughts on themes. Oh, you have.
Well, I was just going to say on that point, I know he talked about how this book was kind of a launching off point into doing a bunch of research about these animals, but that kind of led into him being a bit of an environmental activist. So there may be some themes of like animal protection and stuff.
Oh, let's get into environmental activists, I guess.
Despite blowing up a huge great white shark at the end of the movie.
Right. Yeah.
No, Protect these animals at all costs.
I was talking about the book.
After you blow them up.
But that great white was asking for it, if you know what I mean.
I was specifically talking about the book. In terms of the movie, yeah, Chris, to your point, yeah. Greed and local corruption in the form of basically, yeah, profits over people, literally, in the case of this mayor, to the point where he's willing to lean on a doctor to lie on reports and the whole thing, just showing how it functionally plays out. So much truth to that. Addressing your fears. Yeah. I think the addressing your fears thing is the thing that is closest to carrying over, but it kind of gets tied into learning to put your differences aside and work to accomplish things with others. Because he's trying to give his life meaning. Coming from New York, he felt like he wasn't actually having any impact on his day-to-day life and what he was trying to do in his job. He comes here.
Right.
This is something that it's tangible. It's one shark to deal with. And even though it's a huge goal, it ultimately shakes him out of feeling worthless and gets there in the end. So I think that's the strongest potential through line. I agree. I would have liked to know a little bit more maybe about why he didn't like water, but honestly, I'm okay with it. It gives us the silly, it's only an island if you're looking at it from the outside line or something. It's completely preposterous, but I think it says a lot about him as a character without needing that backstory necessarily. So yeah, I think searching for meaning and a sense of accomplishment is kind of one of the through lines.
Yeah.
Also, I misspoke earlier. Brody does get on a boat prior to getting on the Orca. He and Hooper go out.
But he's not happy about it.
No, he's not. He has to be very drunk.
Yeah, it was interesting hearing the director, Mr. Spielberg, talk about how, and I felt it, like hearing him talk about it, I was like, oh, I actually was thinking about these things while I was watching it, so I felt like I was like on the same wavelength as a creator, where he's talking about, yeah, I had the beginning and I had the end, but the middle was a little, like, I didn't know what I was going to do, and I like felt that watching it. I was like, oh, the middle of this movie is not the strongest part, for sure. It's a little meandering. You know, I feel like that separates the two parts. Clearly from the first part, especially coming out of COVID, it's so hilarious to watch it. I'm like, oh, this seems like a satire of going through COVID. It's so crazy.
It's wild.
It's nuts to see someone go like, there's a problem, I'm calling in experts, and just someone being so blinded by their needs to serve certain interests. To not think about public safety. And I was like, this is so crazy. This is the most prescient thing we've watched about COVID, and it's a movie that about a shark from 1975. But
I'll say especially here in Florida.
Yeah, I mean, the need to open.
We don't have the best leadership here in Florida.
Yeah, the need to just be like, well, we'll ignore facts and just want to open. Oh, we found the threat. We conquered the threat. Let's just say we conquered the threat. Let's just do it. So crazy, and it's so amazing how strong that comes on. And maybe it's 2021 goggles that whole plot and theme is abandoned and not really revisited, right? Then we get into this other thing, which I found like I attached to, like, conquering your fears is definitely like that's the three lines and the main character that they try to reiterate throughout. That is the only thing binding. But I think at the end of the day, what does he do to conquer his fears? He shoots the shark in the mouth or whatever. You know, it's like, that's, to me, it's very thin. It's very like, yes, that connects our whole story, but through the most thin tissue that is necessary for a great blockbuster. And then the second half is far more interesting, I think, from a themes perspective, because one thing that I really thought about heavily, you know, I recently had a talk with my brother about COVID and all that stuff and kind of relating it to the current stuff. And, you know, I'm someone who leans on experts. I have long been a proponent of one of my favorite books is Tom Nichols, the Death of Expertise, which is how we as humans trust each other through vetting, through accreditation, to be experts in a field of study. But how, you know, you always frequently butt up against someone who's on the ground actually doing the work in the shit, and someone high above studying the shit from afar. And both perspectives are always important to understand a crisis or a situation or something that's going on. In Quint and
Uber.
Richard Hooper's character is amazing. It's an incredible, beautiful thing that isn't really brought up until halfway through the movie as a dichotomy, which separates it from the first part, but is super interesting, what I gravitated towards, of Quint, who's literally gone through the horrific scarring event that has most certainly spurred his passion for murdering a creature of a traumatic, just one of the most horrific shark attacks, into his on the ground, right, boots on the ground work of hunting sharks and being like, I am attuned to this creature on almost a spiritual level of understanding how it works. I have become myself a shark to hunt the sharks. And Hooper, who has studied his whole life from an interest and fascination, he's been on the book end of it, of going, I have the most up and coming theories on sharks, and having these two characters have to work together to actually accomplish a goal. One who has hunted sharks for his entire life, but had never seen a predator this big. And same for Hooper, studied the shark for his entire life and city never hands. Seen a city hands, city boy,
city hands. Yeah.
And how cool is it to see this dynamic play out? And I think it's done very well through various moments in the movie, like most absurdly on the nose of the, you've got city hands and I'm not going to deal with this working class hero bullshit. That's when themes are really surface level. But I just really appreciate that, because that is a struggle that we have as humans, is like, what's the on the ground look like and what's the big picture look like? And that dealing and having the cop in the middle of like, I'm the dude who actually like sets policy and has sway both politically and with the people in the ground to like try to make it work. And I found that to be the most interesting part. But because Hooper and Quint aren't introduced until halfway through the movie, you really don't get a holistic view of that entire theme. But I found it still, as for a blockbuster film, tackling that stuff in such an interesting way, and even to the film's credit, something we don't see so clean, because it's so simple. I think 70s movies have this beautiful majesty in the format that it's hard to compare to modern films. Modern films have to deal with a lot more complexity in social interaction, and 70s films have to deal with Quint hits the radio with a bat, and now our heroes are completely isolated from the outside world. You know, like, our main character has to study from books with limited resources, right? There's this beautiful majesty of filmmaking in a two-hour film with the limitations of the technology of the 70s that really put it in a special place that I don't know is completely feasible in our modern filmmaking, that make it like really special, though, that it's able to simplify but also add this the layers of humanity and complexity to that dichotomy, which is what I, you know, personally like find the most enthralling as far as the themes of the film. And to me, the reason it's not perfect is because that most interesting part is solely on the back end and ends with Hooper losing his science weapon and and Quint not being able to brutally fight off the shark, which is thematic. The way that those characters go is thematic. You know, nerd loses his tools, and the strong man isn't strong enough for a 25-foot shark. So it works in that way. But again, not to me holistically. The thing that saves it is honestly the introduction of Quint, which happens in the first act, which is at this point a parody of film, which is this, like, the whole room quiets and they turn around and see Quint. He's like, I'll hunt the goddamn shark. One of the things I found fascinating, and I'll move on because at this point I've been ranting for like 6 minutes and no one wants to hear me rant for 6 minutes, but the original way that Spielberg wanted to introduce Quint, which shows Spielberg's, like, thank God that Spielberg can't do all the nerd shit he wants to do. Limitations are a beautiful tool of filmmaking. He originally wanted Quint to be watching Moby Dick, which was a 60s version.
It's a little on the nose.
Yeah.
Watching Moby Dick, watching them hunting the whale, and laughing at the cinema, which I think would have been so pretentious and not worked, especially watching it now. We just wouldn't have the context. It was such a young filmmaking way of, like, I'm going to outsmart the other artist. You know, the stuff that Bo Burnham does so well, but Spielberg probably wouldn't have pulled off so well. It's fun in concept. And when you think of where Spielberg's head is at, you know, he wants him to be looking at the previous movie interpretations of this and laughing at the ridiculous and not way that Spielberg was going to do it, which was, like, super real. And I think that's so funny, and the fact that he had a compromise on this, like, now what is a trope, an excellent way to introduce a character as, like, listen, I'm the one who can hunt the shark, and I'll do it for a super high price. And both main character, you know, the mayor and Brody going, like, now we'll pass on that for now. We'll try to figure it out ourselves, is a super cool way to tie the back end and front end together. And thank God for that scene, because if that scene wasn't in it, the movie would literally feel kind of silly bringing up this other character so late in the
film.
Right,
out of the blue.
Yeah, out of the deep blue sea. So, you know, Spielberg is able to save it in his edit, in his cut, and I think make the movie work as a whole and for in the memories of everybody for a long time. But again, Chris, to fight against the perfection of the movie, I think some of the coolest things working in the movie don't appear until the back half.
Understandable that you feel that way.
I'm really glad you brought up that dichotomy between Hooper and Quint, though, because feel like I was aware of it, but the way you put it just summed it up so perfectly, and it really is a nice thing that they're doing between them.
No, it's definitely one of the most captivating and interesting elements of the movie, I have to say. They're both delivering wonderful performances.
And prescient. I'm going to overbear the point of COVID, because we're still coming out of the grips of COVID. If you're listening to our Jaws review in 2025 and you're like, COVID, wasn't that thing where my dad couldn't go to work for a year? Not to belabor the point, but, you know, when it comes to, like, right now we're talking about vaccinations. I've, for the record, I've been fully vaccinated. Chris, I know you're, and Brian, you're about to have your second dose. And it's because people who make and review vaccines seem to think it's cool. It's interesting because talking to, you know, we're from Florida. We live in Florida, and we're like a mixed, we're a swing state, red and blue, deep runs through our veins. And, you know, a lot of people on the red side of the field have a lot of concerns about the vaccines. Some, I think, reasonable. Some, I think, not so much. And it's funny because I talked to some people that are close to me that are hesitant about the vaccine. And they're like, I talked to some nurses and I talked to my general practice doctor and they were hesitant about the vaccine. What's interesting is when I hear that, I, you know, studying in the field and like the field of work that I am, it's interesting because the nurse is the blue collar worker of, like, I'm down in the shit and I see it this way. And you've got to have the nerd up top being like, well, you know, in general, this works. And those two things having to come together and make compromise on how to tackle man versus nature, to tackle that goal. And it's not pretty, and both have, like, legitimately, like, valid points and valid experience with stuff. And it's a constant struggle we have with trying to think about how to tackle problems. It's like, well, you got the person that's, like, poking the needles in everybody's arm, and you got the person that's studying the overall concept of vaccination, and how are these two people communicating effectively, and how does that work out in society? And it's really cool when you can take a movie about like three dudes on a boat hunting a shark and be like, wow, that really rings resonant and true to, like, a current thing happening in life. And I think that's attributed to the, you know, the writers and the people that adopt the books and Spielberg himself. So yeah, that tangent aside about vaccines, I should, on this podcast, we should stop talking about vaccines. I just feel like we belabor the point too much.
No, I think it speaks to the timelessness of this movie, right? The fact that we can tie it so seamlessly. Absolutely. To today.
Just a perfect blockbuster. Really can't get any better of a blockbuster than this movie. Let's move in.
Loyal listeners, email us at popaholicscast@gmail.com.
Is that our next poll? Chris,
tell us,
that's going to be the poll. That's going to be the poll. You know what? Forget it. That's going to be the poll.
All right. You know, God, this has been a jam-packed couple episodes we're having here. Let's move on into some of our favorite moments from Jaws. Floor is open.
I've got a couple. My first favorite moment is kind of a sweeter moment between Brody and his youngest son. After the young boy is killed at the beach, Brody has to go home to his children, and with the knowledge that he knew that there was a shark out there, and he didn't stand up against the mayor and close the beaches down as he thought that he should, and it ended up in a little boy dying. So it's him having experienced this horrible day, sitting at the dinner table with his youngest, and the youngest is mimicking all of Brody's movements. And it's just this really sweet scene between the two of them. And it ends with both of them making kind of like monster, like silly monster faces at one another, and then Brody asking the little boy to give him a kiss. But Spielberg's able to do this a lot.
Give daddy a kiss, will you?
And then he's like, why? Because I need it. But it really speaks to how well I think Spielberg is able to direct children, which we later see again over the course of his entire career with E.T. and directing Drew Barrymore at such a young age. And this is a theme in Jurassic Park. You have the children as well, but he's very good at directing children. And he's also very good at finding actors who are good at working with children, which I think speaks to that element of like childlike wonder that we were talking about earlier, Christian. But it's just a very sweet scene, and I really like it. Another one of my favorite scenes is one of the most famous scenes from this movie, but when they're all sitting on the orca toward the end of the film, and Hooper and Quint are comparing scars, basically, at the table, and it ends with Quint giving that whole monologue about the USS Indianapolis taking the bomb to Japan and all those men being attacked by sharks after you know, being hit by the submarine.
I felt like I wasn't breathing for like multiple minutes. It's just rapturous.
It's a very human moment. And very emotional. But yeah, that I feel like I'm not contributing anything new to that scene. That's widely considered one of the best scenes from this movie. And then finally, I just think Richard Dreyfuss overall, over the course of the entire film, is delivering a wonderfully comedic performance. In all of his interactions, he's doing an excellent job. And there are multiple times that I laughed out loud at his performance. And this is not a comedy. It's not a comedy film. But it's just such a fun character. Hooper's such a fun character. I really enjoy it. And one last thing about Richard Dreyfuss. Sorry. He actually didn't want to be in the movie originally. He thought it was going to be a pain in the ass to shoot, and he tried to convince Spielberg to actually leave the project as well.
Oh my gosh. Well, I guess he wasn't wrong on some level, but
being in it. Oh yeah, it was a pain in the ass to shoot, but they did it. Brian, you were saying.
So just going from Richard Dreyfuss, when Hooper is describing the girl who's been attacked on the like the operating table, just the way he's describing it, it's after we've seen Brody start looking through books and seeing some like what shark attacks look like, but somehow it's even more horrifying when he's just describing how the tissue is distributed, and then he pulls the arm up and it's that perfect disgusting prop, and it's just like, I don't know, it just skeezes me out just to think about it. But it's one of the most effective moments in the movie for me. Also, to his comedic side, at some point he's trying to get a picture and he's trying to get Brody to stand towards the front of the ship, and he says, I need to have something in the foreground to give it some scale. Brody's like, foreground my ass. And it just felt like so perfectly meta for everything they're trying to do with making the shark look huge against the boat and right. against the people. And I was really tickled by that this time around. Like you said, we've already talked everything with Quint. It can't be understated how great Robert Shaw is and how much of a character he is, who starts off nearly as a parody of himself. And then
Richard Dreyfuss literally says, like, he went too hard on set. He's like literally kind of butthurt about, like, no, he was a little too committed. I think he was just too into it.
Their character dynamic translated over into the real world. And
oh, interesting.
Shaw was actually pretty hard on Richard Dreyfuss.
Wow. Well, it shows. He's definitely embodying him. Other couple favorites. I mentioned it a little bit earlier, but when Brody is just throwing the chum just absentmindedly, and Jaws pops up before he even turns around.
The shark's name is not Jaws, Brian.
Well, okay, the shark.
Jaws the shark.
Is it named Bruce?
What did we call him earlier? Mr. Jaws. The animatronic shark is named Bruce. Yeah.
Baron Jaws.
Do you know how long I've been living in the seas? I don't know why I'm doing that accent. I was trying to do Baron
like a Zemo.
Yeah, nope. And I went for like weird Middle East. I'm done. Sorry. Sorry, listeners.
No, you're fine. The last one. I just want to say I talked about it earlier, but this man is just ridiculously bold. So we start off, it's just like the classic horror movie. You've got drunk teenagers, drunk college kids who go out and get murdered, like kind of a classic slasher thing. Then we kill a dog. Then we kill a child. And it's just like, who won't
they
be
broke
murdered
two rules.
In this movie? I was just kind of like blown away that it happened. Like, oh wow, we're really going for it.
I do want to like mention,
you're never supposed to kill dogs and you're never supposed to kill kids.
I want to mention why it works and why in other, I was trying to compare it. I'm like, why does like Jaws 4 not work? Why does, you know, these like the Shallows or whatever the fuck, why don't these work as well as Jaws? And I think the important thing is like, there's an acknowledgement of the weight of the situation that Spielberg is very, and the writers are very keen to always make sure have weight. We do not feel like any of these deaths are meaningless. They matter to the audience. They matter to the film. And I think that's huge. And that shouldn't be forgotten, that people, and that's something I'll correlate to Deep Blue Sea. One thing that stuck out to me in Deep Blue Sea is like, when people die, there's characters in shock, right? And I think Deep Blue Sea understands this, and that happens throughout. There's one point where some of the characters are shaking, and like, I just watched my friend get eaten, and they acknowledge and they take the time to do that. And a lot of like low budget B movie horror and slasher films, it's characters being like, Dave died. Well, fuck Dave. Well, I've got a joke to cover it up. Whatever, we're moving on. And it's like, in this movie, it takes like 5 minutes to have a scene of the mother who's lost her child come up and slap our main character going, you should have done more. And that was my child. And that moment when all the kids, oh my God, all the kids were like, there's blood in the water. All the children leave the ocean and all of them are grabbing their children. And the one mother comes out and goes like, Steve, where's Steve at? I don't know the kid's not his name, Steve.
Alex, I think Alex.
Yeah, comes out and it's like, where's my kid? And you're like, that's the fucking kid. And it just has, it like, it matters more, right? And that's what gives the shark scariness. It adds to the fear of like, this will take my child and I'm going to watch my kid. And probably why my mom was like really terrified of me going in the ocean is because of the weight of it. And because we get this moment of seeing a mother that has lost her child reckoning with it. And the movie takes time to care about it. And like, to me, that is what defines this against and should be a huge takeaway to creators creating like horror and scary movies like this is like, make it matter. It needs to matter. If it doesn't matter, then what does matter? Make jokes.
What are we doing here?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So final couple things. This one's well known, but the scene where Hooper jumps off the boat at night, it's just like, no freaking way. And the way that you're anticipating it's going to be Jaws and then it's the dead body, it's kind of a jump scare, but it's perfectly executed for me and gets me every time I've watched this movie.
Yeah.
Finally,
do you mind if I piggyback off of
go
that,
for
Brian?
It, Chris. Yeah, sure.
One thing that we've talked about John Williams' score, but one thing that we haven't really talked about is how the Jaws theme represents the shark. It's the embodiment of the shark throughout the whole film in those sequences where we're not able to see the shark. And I think that that scene when Hooper is in the water and he's discovered the dead body and he's coming back to the surface and we're hearing the Jaws theme, what that tells us as an audience is that the shark is in the water somewhere, possibly, and it adds this level of dread. So I just and wanted to make sure we touched on that.
It's actually like embodied really smartly, where it's like, where do you not hear the Jaws theme? Jaws theme doesn't play when the kids have the fake fin. You never hear the Jaws right. theme then. And it's only when you learn the shark is in the pond, then the theme starts playing and you're like, oh, this is the real deal. That's when it actually adds like of like the theme is always telling you something about story. And this is such a great lesson in like how to compose music and themes and motifs. Like the Jaws theme is a motif that reoccurs for a reason and specifically in specific parts. And like, again, it matters. The theme matters. You know, the Avengers theme works well in all of our Marvel movies when the avenging is about to happen, right? If you just play the Avenger theme willy-nilly, it doesn't matter. It's like you cheapen it. It means less. And it's important to tie music in the same way that you tie in characters' deaths in the importance of human life. Music is the same way. It needs to be tied to something concrete. And John Williams certainly gets that. And Spielberg realized that and was like, you're going to be my dude for a while. Also, you can go over and help George. He needs help. Your music's really going to make his shit work.
They were in the same social circles.
They were in the filmmaking rat pack, as it was. What was it? De Palma, Spielberg, Lucas.
Yes, De Palma, Lucas, Scorsese, Spielberg, Coppola.
Scorsese?
Coppola and Scorsese?
Yeah. I think that's the 70s filmmaking rat pack there.
Sounds right. Okay, last moment. It's a beautiful calm before the storm character moment when Quint has Jaws potentially hooked and everything is quiet, but he's strapping in to the boat and just getting all set up. The tension is absolutely flawless. It's just like, this is what movies are about.
That scene directly, I was like, oh yeah, Spielberg, you're the same director, was in Jurassic Park when he's lining up for the shot and you just get that little clip and he's like pulling, he's cocking it back and spot he's ready in his rifle and he's pulling out the stock and everything. It's like the same exact formula and it works almost probably better in this shot. It's really good because
I'm really glad that you brought that up, Christian.
Did you vibe the same way? Were you like, yeah, that's
yes. There are multiple times throughout watching this movie where I was like, oh, this is like a prototypical Jurassic Park. Like he's using all the same elements to express tension and fear. What is it? 20 years later?
Yeah.
In Jurassic Park, they're all the same techniques. But yeah, you can definitely see the through line with cinematic techniques with Spielberg here. And I love that.
We got to get those two gifts side by side. Quint readying his rod.
It's really awesome.
And what's his name? The Velociraptor dude. Don't remember his name.
Oh my gosh.
As is typical of Popaholics, Christian doesn't know anybody's names or any characters.
Is it Muldoon?
You know, that sounds right. Say it was. I'd repeat it instantly as if I were right. Favorite moments for me. I always love, it takes a while to get there. I think it's like, it might be the latest in a Spielberg movie we get beaming flashlight through. We get it about midway point. We get the beaming foggy flashlight. He really builds up to it, which I thought was pretty incredible that it took so long to get there. I'd shout it out, just like general cinematography just like really stood out, especially on the front half to me. It's just like, especially that Blu-ray transfer. It's just like delectable. Like specifically, like you guys have mentioned, like a lot of the good ones. I just think this movie's just, you know, chock full of all of them. I love the moment, you know, I really love it. It's so cheesy. It is, again, while this is a perfect blockbuster, when
he's not going to give it up.
His wife, who's a little underwritten for modern age, she's a little underwritten, you know, a little bit, and probably
it was 1975, Christian.
It was a different type, Christian. Whatever. Anyway, they're at the dinner table. That's a whole great scene where he comes in and eats dinner, brings the wine, and he takes it out and he just pours the entire full glass and then gives them all their like proper glass of wine. And
but again, a great character moment for Hooper. Because you can tell his wealth from that moment where he's like, oh, you might want to let that breathe.
Yeah,
but
yeah, exactly.
Brody's like, I don't give a fuck. I had the worst day. I just want to get drunk.
Yeah, right.
For sure. And then the wife's like lack of dialogue reminds you it's 1975. Anyway, so he pours it up. Yeah. It's good. And he's like, you want to go cut open that shark? Because he's like, yeah, we should probably get down to the bottom of this. And the wife's like, can you do that? And he goes, of course I can. I'm the chief of police. that's something that kicks off kind of our midpoint and propels and reminds you that like he's a get shit done kind of guy, right? Which I think the movie wants you to think from the very get-go, but he's not a perfect man. I think that's like one of my most like that's one of the things I appreciate about this is like he doesn't come across as just like this like the pinnacle of sexiness and comedy and all. It's not trying to paint him. He seems very Tom Hanksian.
He's an average Joe. Yeah, an everyman.
Yeah, who's kind of trying to overcome some trauma from where he lives. He's trying to get away, and so yeah, I appreciate all that. I'm trying to think of. Yeah, I mean, we briefly mentioned it, but the monologue that it's not a monologue, it's a conversation that each character having when they're sharing the scars. It's like, come on, there's not much that needs to be said other than it's written very well, it's acted very well, and it's like the linchpin of the third act of the characters actually coming together. It's the Avengers need a reason to fight the bad guy kind of thing. And they're singing the sea chanty and the fucking shark is like busting open the shit. And I just love how the boat is slowly just coming apart. And yeah, dude, whatever. Let's just talk about every scene in this movie. It's great.
You know, I do have to say though, and I know that Kevin Smith was hugely inspired by this film. It's like one of the reasons why he became a filmmaker. It's so hard for me to watch that scene where they're comparing scars and not think about the scene in Chasing Amy when they're comparing sexual scars in the bar.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like directly pulled.
Oh wow, that's so funny. That makes perfect sense.
It's so difficult for me to like separate those two things. But hey,
no, I was in for it because I love Chasing Amy, but I'm just not like as tied in it. The scene is much more self-serious and especially.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Yeah. But the point where Hooper like pulls out his chest and he's like, and that's where this girl broke my heart. I was like,
excellent.
And I was like, I grabbed my ale and I was like, cheers. And they started singing and I was like, I want to sing with a bunch of boys on a boat while I'm hunting a shark. I was just like so in it, you know. It's like I'm in the moment.
It's that Ford v Ferrari, just like full dad feels
of like,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I want to quote everything Quint says, which is totally inappropriate and awful and misogynistic. So it's Jaws, dude. Go if you haven't seen it. It's a great movie. What are we doing? Why do we have a podcast? We're hot takes. Jaws is good. Christian did have a hot take. Was like, yeah, it's not a perfect movie, but
there it is.
I can't wait for that poll.
Yeah,
honestly,
I'm interested to see. I think the blockbuster's taking it. I think I'm pretty confident that we're good. But I've been confident and I've been wrong more than I've been right. So wouldn't bet the house on it. Wouldn't bet all the doge in the world.
We'll see.
All right. Any final thoughts? Fucking Jaws, right?
I think we've been through it. Yeah, it's amazing. I'm so happy that we are watching.
If for some reason you haven't seen Jaws, what are you doing here? Go watch Jaws.
Oh, standout star character we didn't mention is the fucking barrels. Barrels make the entire third act work in every single way. The barrel concept is the linchpin of the entire third act. Just the concept of harpooning with barrels is like, oh, that's the only reason any of the suspense, any of the plot, any of the drama works is
just like the theme music. It's a way for Spielberg to get around showing the actual shark.
Right, right.
He can use the barrels to identify the shark's location, which is genius.
But just the way they pop up and they move. Yeah. Oh, I didn't mention. Oh, favorite thoughts. Oh, sorry. God, I'm terrible at this podcasting thing. My favorite scene by far is the one where the dudes take the meatloaf and try to like the wife's roast.
Oh, the roast.
They just destroy the dock. Incredible.
Cause
the tension there. Oh my God. Yeah. When he's swimming back.
To your point, Chris, the show Don't Tell, everybody's talked about it before, but in my opinion, the buoys, the little barrels, are the third act's way of doing that. But nowhere else in the film is it as effective as the dock turning around, which is
it's great.
From watching those docks,
crawl out of my skin.
One of the few things Spielberg actually came up with conceptually from a plot and like a scene perspective, and why it feels a little disjointed, I think, from the rest of the film. But nonetheless, is like that is the embodiment of Spielberg understanding the show don't tell aspect of it. That dock, when it spun around, I was like, oh, you motherfucker, Spielberg. Goddamn. That's good. That's good. That's good shit. That's probably my favorite scene, and I think encapsulates why the tension of Jaws works. You can just watch that scene and understand it completely.
It's honestly very well executed.
It makes me think of that scene in 2014 Godzilla. We get a kind of similar scene of a guy sitting on a dock when Godzilla shows up. It's a little more showy, but I'm really glad you brought that up, Christian, because that's a great scene.
I think it's supposed to be
a reference,
a cheesy homage to Jaws.
Yeah, probably.
Isn't everything. So much is. And it's like, it's a testament of such a good film that like you can watch it and go, I see all the shitty movies that, and like okay movies that embodied this, but this movie is still so watchable. It's still so good. I question how much I have faith in its watchability. I do want to know some Gen Zers. So Gen Zers out there, popolicscast@gmail.com. Watch Jaws. Is it as watchable as we think? I'd really be curious to know, because it seems like Breaking Bad in the water with Look at the Shark. It seems like excellent filmmaking. Is that our bias?
I would hope that
are
it's
we
watchable.
Biased? Do we need a Gen Z? Or we need to get a Gen Z or co-host. Send us your reels. Send us your TikToks. Let's know what you got.
I would predict this, and this might be like the unfortunate truth of the situation, and that I feel like there have been so many parodies of Jaws since its release that people younger than us probably wouldn't be able to take Jaws as seriously as we take Jaws, or Jaws even takes.
But I haven't seen Jaws from A to B. You know, like this was the first time I literally watched it like A to B, and it didn't take the scenes that I had seen, and the nostalgia of that was like it's just so well made. I don't know.
But again, you're also
30 years old.
You're a child of the 90s. You know what Spielberg's capable of, and you go into the film with that mindset.
Sure.
So,
sure.
Who's to say?
We got to get
other
some,
than a Gen Zer.
Let's pay some Gen Zers. We got to start a Patreon so we can afford to pay. We'll do that thing where teens react to Jaws or whatever.
I'm sure it already exists. We could probably find it and get our answers.
No news stories are told, as it were. Jaws. There we go. That'll
bring it
for
into
Jaws.
Summer Spielberg.
Summer's springing into Summer Spielberg. So we talked about Jaws. You know, there's another movie I haven't watched. I saw more of Jaws than I've seen of this movie. I've only seen very select scenes, and that
Christian, I'm so excited.
I'm very excited myself as well. Chris, what are we talking about next week?
Christian, next week we're talking about a Spielberg movie that I too have not seen. And that is The Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
War Horse.
I'm super excited.
Oh, yeah. Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah, right. Yeah, War Horse. No, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. We'll be watching that. Feel free to watch it with us and then come listen to us talk about it.
And just to be clear, we're going to be watching the director's cut, the final
correct
cut of this movie.
Correct. Also known as the collector's edition. Is that what you said, Brian?
Yes, so there's a special edition that has some stuff that he regrets adding in. The final collector's edition / director's cut has stuff from the theatrical and the special edition, and he thinks that is Spielberg's definitive version of the movie.
Perfect.
Very exciting. It'll be cool to try to go into something new and get some fresh perspective. You having seen it, Brian, so that's cool. So that's going to do it for this episode of Popaholics. Please email us at popaholicscast@gmail.com, especially if you're Gen Z or watching Jaws. Definitely want to hear your opinions there. As well as if you have any other questions, comments, or concerns, we love reading listener emails. You can also subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast player. We'd really appreciate that. And rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Helps out the algorithms. Lets us know what you think of the show. Write something in. We read those aloud on our weekly uploads, which are every Monday, where we catch you up to date with the latest news in pop culture and talk about what we've been consuming in the world of pop culture. Gentlemen, where can people follow you directly on the social medias?
Loyal listeners, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Conkling, talking about all things nerdy, television, movies, video games, comics, collectibles, you name it, I'm talking about it.
And you can find me at True Popaholic.
And you can find my music project, Midnight Satire, at Midnight Satire. It's also streaming on Spotify and Apple Music. If you want to hear whatever this dude has to say in melody form with guitars, that's what's happening there. Cool stuff coming. I promise.
Love it.
Love it. Like it. Follow. That'll do it for this episode. We're very excited for the next springing into Spielberg summer and all our weekly uploads this month. We'll catch you on the next one. On.